From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Easy Rider. Just shy of its 30th birthday, this classic hippie biker film has joined the establishment. The Library of Congress has added it to the National Film Registry.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway.
On this archive edition, we feature interviews with Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper, who made and starred in Easy Rider. And director Roger Corman tells us about making the biker film that inspired Easy Rider. Born to be filed in the Library of Congress on today's Fresh Air.
Fire all of the guns at once and explode into space. I like smoking lightning. Heavy metal thunder. Racing with the wind. And the feeling that I'm under.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Chad Pergram. Many members of Congress are spending their holiday weekend still uncertain what to do about impeachment proceedings against President Clinton, NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Some Democrats have introduced proposals to censure President Clinton for his behavior in the Monica Lewinsky affair, and some Republicans say they also favor some punishment short of impeachment. But supporters of censure face problems. Some Democrats want no punishment at all. Some moderate Republicans say censure sets a bad precedent or that it's unconstitutional. And many House Republicans are still willing to consider impeaching the president on charges that he lied under oath. As lawmakers consider their options, President Clinton has returned to work at the White House today. It's expected he'll give final approval to answers to 81 questions from the House Judiciary Committee. Aides say that in his answers, the president will avoid saying much more than he's already said in his grand jury testimony and elsewhere. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
British Home Secretary Jack Straw has an extra week to decide if former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet should be extradited to Spain. British judges announced their ruling today. Straw has been trying to determine whether to send Pinochet to Spain to face charges of genocide and torture. Pinochet has been held in Britain after his arrest last month. Earlier this week, Britain's highest court ruled that Pinochet was not immune from prosecution. There was new violence today between Palestinians and Jews on the West Bank in the divided city of Hebron. Steve McNally reports from Jerusalem.
The clash began when Palestinian residents of Hebron found their access to a shared road blocked by members of Hebron's Jewish minority. The Israelis oppose a decision to reopen the road to Palestinian traffic, saying Palestinians use it to get close to and to attack Jewish homes. They briefly blocked the road, and some began a march from their enclave into the Palestinian section. The Palestinians responded with a hail of stones, forcing the army to come to the settlers' defense with volleys of rubber-coated bullets. Hebron is a frequent flashpoint. Yasser Arafat controls the larger part, but Israel controls the downtown core, where 450 Jewish families live. Critics of the Y River deal say it will spread the same problems which plague Hebron to the rest of the West Bank. For NPR News, this is Steve McNally in Jerusalem.
Kremlin officials said today that Russian President Boris Yeltsin should be able to complete his term in office barring a worsening of his health. The 67-year-old Yeltsin has been hospitalized this week for pneumonia, the latest round in several bouts of illness. Yeltsin's term expires in mid-2000. Concern about Yeltsin's health has prompted political maneuvering behind the scenes. Yeltsin met earlier this week with Chinese leader Jiang Zemin while still in the hospital. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 28 points at 93.42 in light trading of 187 million shares. The Nasdaq is up 18 at 2004. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, some shoppers went to the stores well before the sun came up this morning on what is usually one of the busiest shopping days of the year. The hot toy this year is a doll called a Furby. At a West Virginia Walmart, about 500 people were waiting before the store opened to get inside and buy a Furby. A toy store in Cambridge, Massachusetts, sold out of the Furby supply at 6:05 this morning. On the last day of a holiday-shortened trading week, investors are pushing stocks higher, though trading is light today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
On the day after Thanksgiving, shoppers may be out in full force today, but for Wall Street traders, not a whole lot of activity. In fact, stock and bond markets both close early today. The biggest news on Wall Street today remains the anticipated merger of Exxon and Mobil, creating what would be the world's largest energy company. The two companies confirmed today they are in merger talks, but added those talks could still fall apart It's expected Exxon would acquire Mobil for between $50 and $60 billion. Dow stock Philip Morris rose today after the company announced it's discounting the price of its best-selling Marlboro brand, and two of the online retailers are seeing huge movements in their stocks today. Stock in Books A Million, Inc., an online bookseller, is up more than $21 a share today. Stock in On Sale, Inc., is up more than $22. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The chief executive of Barclays, Britain's second-largest bank, has resigned after a lower-than-expected profit forecast. The British stock exchange, the FTSE, reacted negatively to the news as traders began unloading Barclays shares, pushing their value down as much as 9%. Overall for the year, Barclays has underperformed the stock index by 15%. Barclays has also incurred losses this year in Russian investments. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, the Library of Congress announced its annual selection of 25 movies to be added to the National Film Registry. The films chosen for their cultural, historical, or aesthetic significance include The Bride of Frankenstein, 42nd Street, Gun Crazy, Phantom of the Opera, The Public Enemy, Steamboat Willie, Tootsie, and the hippie biker classic Easy Rider.
This used to be a hell of a good country. I can't understand what's going on with it. Man, everybody got chicken, that's what happened. Hey, we can't even get into, like, a second-rate hotel. I mean, a second-rate motel, you dig? Don't they think we're gonna cut their throat or something, man? Like, they're scared, man. Oh, they're not scared of you. They're scared of what you represent to them. Hey, man. All we represent to them, man, is somebody who needs a haircut. Oh, no. What you represent to them is freedom.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it's all about, all right. But talking about it and being it, that's two different things.
On today's Archive Edition, we'll hear from the two people who made and starred in Easy Rider, Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper. They played two hippie drifters getting high while riding their motorcycles in search of the real America. Jack Nicholson played their alcoholic lawyer friend. I spoke with Peter Fonda last March after the publication of his memoir, Don't Tell Dad. Dad, of course, was actor Henry Fonda. When we spoke, Peter Fonda was up for an Academy Award for his performance in the film Yuli's Gold, which is now out on video.
The roles that you first really became famous for were biker roles. So before we get to some of those roles, how did you first meet Dennis Hopper, who was your collaborator on early films? You even wrote a screenplay together before shooting Wild Angels and Easy Rider.
Right. I met Dennis at the reception to his wedding to a person named Brooke Hayward, whom I'd grown up with and was like kind of my older sister, like Jane. But not really like Jane in the long run. We all kind of got damaged together, you might say. And so at her wedding, I was there. The reception was held at my sister's apartment in New York in 1960, and that's when I met Dennis the first time.
And what hooked you up together? I mean, what did you see in each other?
A certain energy and frustration and the ability to collaborate to break through that, and the ability to find ideas that were new and different. And fortunately for me, I got turned on to some of the great bits of American art. The artists themselves, their work, the pop art scene, everything Dennis was into, I just absorbed like a sponge. So he was a gateway to lots of cool things that were happening in my life.
Well, you wrote a screenplay together called Yin and Yang, and I think it was that screenplay that led you to Roger Corman. And Roger Corman cast you in his film Wild Angels, which was about bikers, about the Hell's Angels.
Notice how you had to stammer just for a second. It was about, what was it about?
Yeah, what could it possibly be about? Let me think.
Nazi paraphernalia, raping somebody in a church. That's basically what the whole bottom line was.
Well, this was the leader of a Hell's Angels gang. A kind of real switch from previous roles that you had in movies like Tammy and the Doctor and Lilith. What did you think of yourself as being the biker?
Well, I mean, I liked the job I did in Lilith. I thought I fit the bill well, and in my later years now, I'm enjoying hearing that from people. But I didn't want to be cast as the sensitive roles all the time, and that's what my agents had in mind for me. They thought they wanted me to become the next Dean Jones for Disney. I had other thoughts afoot here. I was a bit too radical for that. And so I started to strike out in a different way.
Now, what do you think Corman cast you in the biker role?
I think he saw me as this very rebellious person who didn't give a rat's ass and went out there and just did what was most, I guess, obnoxious, or at least what shook the cage, whatever would shake the cage the most into any kind of really set in legislative morality. I really believe that abstract morality has no place in our political or our everyday lives, and I mean, arbitrary morality and abstract authority certainly doesn't. So he saw me as somebody who was always watching for something to step on that looked like abstract authority or arbitrary morality. It's been a long time since I've had to talk about arbitrary morality.
So listen, when you were cast in Wild Angels, were you already riding a motorcycle?
Yeah, I'd been riding around a lot with various other glitterati, McQueen, and Brando, myself, Ted Marklin, people that...
Oh, boy, it would have been fun to see you and Brando, who had also played a biker, riding around together.
Oh, yeah, actually, he asked me to come by his house one afternoon. He said, come by my house. I left my motorcycle down at Wally Cox's. Would you take me down there? I said, sure, bud. We called him Bud because that was what he was known as a young man in Omaha. A junior in the Midwestern term is always known as Bud. Instead of Marlon Jr. or Junior, he was called Bud. And I said, yeah, Bud, I'll come by. He said, but bring your Bonneville. I had a Triumph Bonneville. And, you know, I thought maybe a car would suffice, but, oh, sure, you can ride in the back of my motorcycle. As we're riding down Ventura Boulevard, trying to beat the rain, Marlon leaned forward and whispered in my ear, did you hate your father? I thought to myself, that's the strangest question to have come from this dude who's holding on his arms around me. I'm wondering, why does he have his arms around me? What am I in for with Marlon here?
What'd you say?
I just said no. Right. In the long run, Marlon, no. And I talk about it in that way in the book. Uh-huh. An example that, in fact, I knew that I loved my father. I was confused and wondered whether he loved me.
I think it's time to hear a scene from Wild Angels, your first biker film. And now, in this scene, you're at the funeral of a biker played by Bruce Dern, and his coffin is covered by a Nazi flag. There's mm-hmm. a minister delivering a eulogy, which you think is really phony, so you interrupt the eulogy to say this.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
I apologize. But tell me, just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. We want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. That's what we're going to do.
Away, baby. Let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party. Yeah!
And as you can hear, they are totally tearing apart the church.
I warned you about that one already.
Peter Fonda, your thoughts listening back to this scene?
Far out.
that's groovy would be the other alternative.
No, not groovy, just far out. And, you know, what the heck. You would have to pick that scene. I didn't write it.
Who did?
I can't remember.
How did those lines sound to you at the time? You want to be free to not be hassled by the man.
I thought I had a better way of saying it, but I was reminded that I was playing the leader of a motorcycle gang and didn't necessarily have a larger vocabulary.
My guest is Peter Fonda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Peter Fonda.
Now, there is a poster of you from this movie that you say sold what, 16 million copies in America or something like that?
Easily, yeah.
How seriously did you take yourself at the time as a biker icon?
I didn't even put those two things together. I was brought into Corman's office. He was over at 20th Century Fox, had a deal making films over there. And he said he wanted to make, and my hair was rather long, and I was considered a weird hippie. And he said he wanted to make a motorcycle movie, a movie about the Hells Angels that wasn't making a statement, which I found to be rather far out, because I think anytime you make a movie about the Hells Angels, you're covering statement all over the place. So I thought, well, let's see if he can do it. I said, I'm in. And eventually I was called. And actually, the first time I was called to play Bruce Dern's part.
The loser.
The loser, yeah. And I said, oh, I can do this one easily. Anyway, it turned out that the fellow who's cast to play the part that I ended up playing didn't know how to ride a motorcycle, so I got the gig. But at the same price I got to play for being the loser, who's a stiff for about a third of the film.
Right. And, now, it's funny, when you were young and going to boarding school and private school, you write that you had the image of being a sissy, and for a while you were even called Fairy Fonda. That was in part because you had to play the role of a fair maiden in the Pirates of Penzance at an old boys' school.
Also, the fact that I weighed probably 82 pounds.
Yeah, you were real, like, skinny marink at the time. Not that you ever put on a lot of weight in later life, but anyways, it's a kind of far cry from that image, you know, from the sissy image that you had to, you know, the biker.
Worked.
Did you like that change? Did you find it amusing, or did you take it really seriously?
Well, that particular part of the change I found very amusing. And even writing the script with Dennis, it was a lot of fun and an amusement to it. I was definitely bent to do something different in my life, and I went for it. Next film, what are you going to do next? Let me find out if I should chain myself to this chair and handcuff myself so I don't come crawling through the mic.
I have a question about Roger Corman's The Trip, but you'll be spared from any clips.
Roll the clips. I can handle it.
Okay. This is an LSD movie with lots of, like, swirling psychedelic colors intercut in the trip scenes. Now, were you already, I imagine you were already tripping a lot yourself when you shot this movie?
No, you couldn't really do that. I think I'd end up looking at the camera and just starting to crack up, thinking these guys are really serious, aren't they?
No, I don't mean while making the movie, but I mean, I don't mean you were high during the shooting of the movie necessarily, but you already knew a lot about acid trips by the time you made the movie, right?
Not a lot, I think. Probably. I only took my reputation for consumption far exceeds the actual amount of controlled substances that I ever attempted or tried. I knew what it was. I knew what it was. I had had an altered state several times before Roger and I talked about making a movie about that thing, and I tried to get Roger to go for it, too, so he'd know what an altered state was, because I was very specific, and I said, it's not, you know, about flashing lights and swirling things overlaid on images on film. That's what you see in the discotheques, because they don't know how to recreate it. And Jack Nicholson wrote the script, and Jack's script was absolutely brilliant. He did it all with stock footage, some footage that we would shoot, in a cutting matter. In other words, he made the rhythm of the cuts and what the visual image was against your eyes into an altered state. It was a brilliant thing. And Roger copped to the flashing lights and swirling things, overlaid images of the rest of us, which rather disappointed me. But the good part about it all was first that I got to work with Dennis Hopper, who was in the film in a supporting role, by telling Roger, who was not going to shoot some of the images that were really necessary to make something out of it. And Dennis and I went off with the camera and film to the desert and shot stuff of me running through sand dunes and things like that. They intercut very well, but you sure could see the difference in the footage we shot compared to the footage that Roger shot.
Now, how did you and Dennis Hopper decide to do Easy Rider, your own version of a biker film?
Well, as I said, I had been given this as my daily lesson. What it was, I was in Toronto, Canada, in September of 1967, attending a big convention of theater owners and exhibitors and distributors. And at the second day of lunch, with 1,200 people, I was up at a big table of glitterati. Now, I had been through all this, the normal stuff of selling a film, talking to the press, so I had a very nice custom-made double-breasted suit and a really cool shirt and tie and no shoes or socks. So everybody would come in to visit me to interview me, just couldn't take their eyes off the fact that I had bare feet, and they just stared at the bare feet, which was, of course, the desired effect. And actually, the day before, when I was given my lesson by Jack Valenti, he looked right at me as I was sitting down on the floor with the rest of the plebes and said, "We have to stop making movies about motorcycles, sex, and drugs, and start making more movies like Dr. Doolittle, which cost $27 million. And I went back to my room. Okay, no more sex, motorcycles, sex, and drugs movie. But I'd come up with this story the night before I said that line of Easy Rider. Called Dennis on the phone. It was 4:30 Toronto time on the 27th of September, 1967. And 1:30 in L.A. time, and I called Dennis, told him the story that I'd made up, and he said, "That's far out. What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I thought you'd direct it, I'll produce it, we'd both write it and act in it, we could save some money, and I believe we'd make a movie that would be commercially successful." And that's how it started.
What did you want your motorcycle to look like for the movie?
Just what it looked like. All that steel and all that engine between my legs and that red, white, and blue, and star-spangled gas tank. I thought it was like a huge phallic symbol that I'd be riding across the country.
And that's you wanted.
Well, exactly. And Dennis wanted me in white leathers, and I said, no, this is an Evel Knievel. We stay in black leathers. We don't want to count out the S&M crowd from this movie. We want to get as many people in here as possible, and black leather plays a lot better, believe me, Dennis. And so, anyway, I put spurs on even. Very few people realize that I was wearing spurs during that movie. I was trying to tell you we were making a Western that happened to have sex and drugs and motorcycles in it.
Now, time for another scene.
Uh-oh.
In this scene...
This news is getting tighter every time you do this. But I can handle it. I can handle it.
This is one of your scenes in Easy Rider with Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson is an alcoholic lawyer, and in this scene, you're giving him his first joint. You're convincing him. You're convincing him to try marijuana. Let's hear the scene.
Go ahead, George. Light it up.
Oh, no. I couldn't do that. I mean, I've got enough problems with the booze and all. I mean, I can't afford to get hooked.
Huh. You won't get hooked.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, it leads to harder stuff. You say it's all right. Well, all right, then, how do I do it?
Here.
That's got a real nice taste to it, though. I don't suppose it'll do me much good, though. I mean, I'm so used to the booze and everything.
You've got to hold it in your lungs longer, George.
Yeah, I remember that. Of course, there's these long pauses, and you wonder what's going on. It's intercutting between me and Jack and the looks I'm giving it, because I don't really make a comment about whether the grass is good or bad or getting hooked. I just, look at him and smile.
Now, what did your father, Henry Fonda, think of Easy Rider and your image as, the countercultural movie star who rode a motorcycle and went on, trips of both kinds, the acid and road kind?
Well, I'm sure that he wasn't thrilled with the whole thing, but he knew that I was very serious as a producer and that I had put this thing down as an original story and then co-wrote it with Dennis and Terry Southern into a screenplay.
In movie terms, it made a fortune. I mean,
you didn't know that yet.
Right,
and I knew we would make some money, and therefore mm-hmm. Dennis and I would have a track record, and we could make another motion picture. It was later into it that I realized how far out it would go. And my dad, by this time, by the way, I realized we were going to go to a much broader audience than I figured originally. My dad said, you know, this is pretty thin here. I don't think people are going to understand what's happening. I mean, we don't know where you're going. I said, well, Dad, why don't you take the trip with us and find out what we find out, discover what we discover. He said, well, that's pretty thin. I mean, where are you going? We need to know so we can take that trip with you. And I said, well, Dennis says, I'm going down to Mardi Gras. I'm going to get me a Mardi Gras queen in the first campfire. Dad said, well, son, that's a little bit thin. I don't think that'll hang in there. I don't think the audience, I don't think we'll stay with you. And I'm worried for you because I know you've got all your eggs in this basket. And he was entitled to his opinion, which was probably the way the most of the establishment, liberal or conservative, saw the particular movie. But what he hadn't factored in fact, I wish I was smart enough to say that I factored in, was as the Flower Children and hippies came into being, we had our own language, we had our own art, we had our own poetry, music, our whole morality, our customs. What we didn't have was our own movie. And when Easy Rider popped on, that became our own movie, and that transcended everything else and became the icon that it was.
Peter Fonda recorded last March, after the publication of his autobiography, Don't Tell Dad. The Library of Congress just added his 1969 film Easy Rider to the National Film Registry. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Yes. Now if a six turned out to be nine, oh, I don't mind. Cut off all their hair. I don't care. I don't care.
White collar conservative flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me. They're hoping soon my kind will drop and die, but I'm gonna wave my green flag.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music. Available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the making of Easy Rider. We talk with Dennis Hopper, and film director Roger Corman tells us about making the biker film that inspired Easy Rider.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just shook my hand, no was all he said. Take a load off Fanny, take a load for free. Take a load off Fanny, and you put the load, put right, the load on right on me. I picked up my bag, I went looking for a place to hide. When I saw Carmen and the devil walking side by side, I said, hey Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, the Library of Congress added the 1969 hippie biker film Easy Rider to the National Film Registry. Dennis Hopper starred in and made the film with Peter Fonda. I spoke with Dennis Hopper about Easy Rider in 1990.
I have to ask you about Easy Rider, the 1969 film that you co-wrote, directed, and starred in. You had done some work with Roger Corman. Peter Fonda had done some biker-type movies and acid trip movies with Corman. Did you see this as an exploitation film, or did you want it to be a movie in the spirit of the counterculture?
You're talking about the Easy Rider?
Easy Rider, yeah.
I wasn't really thinking about either one of those things. I wanted to win the Cannes Film Festival. I wanted it to be an art film.
Right.
The counterculture was becoming the culture at that time. So I thought I was making a film for everyone. What I did was I showed people smoking marijuana without going out and killing a bunch of nurses for the first time. And I used the music of the day as a time capsule kind of thing rather than writing a score for a movie. It was the first time individual songs had been used for a film. The editing of the cemetery sequence was like a lot of experimental films that I'd seen of the day, Bruce Conner in particular. I'd used a lot of cutting that I'd seen on television for television commercials. We now look at MTV, but if you realize that those rides that I edited to the music, to Jimi Hendrix and to the Byrds and to Dylan and so on, those were the first MTV kind of things, music video kind of things that were ever done.
Were you already doing a lot of drugs when you made Easy Rider, and was that out of control at all?
There was a lot of smoking of grass on that picture. Grass made me paranoid, and I didn't do it. I would do it. I did it like for the scene where Peter and Jack and I are all smoking marijuana, and we see the space people, or Jack talks about space people and so on. But most of the time, I didn't smoke it, only because it made me paranoid. But I drank. I was a drinker. I was a classic drinker in the great tradition of John Huston, Howard Hawks, John Ford, and Dennis Hopper. Now, I was an alcoholic, and I was never a big pot smoker, even though I smoked pot a great deal in my life. I didn't do it while I worked.
What were your paranoid fantasies that it would bring out? Or what form of paranoia would it bring out in you?
Well, it would interfere with the work, and nothing that I did that interfered with the work. The work was the only thing that was important to me. People came to Paul Lewis and I a few years ago. Paul was also the production manager on Easy Rider, and all the films that I've made, he's been with me, the last movie and so on. And so people came and said, how could you have done the last movie doing all that cocaine and so on? We didn't have any cocaine on Easy Rider. We just made it popular. That was baking soda that I chose to use in Easy Rider. But anyway, I went to Peru and I made a movie called The Last Movie, which I won the Venice Film Festival with, which was never distributed. It's a long story. But we used a lot of cocaine on that movie. And people said, how could you make a movie and drink and use cocaine and smoke grass and so on? And Paul said, are you serious? We were making movies. You know, it wasn't anything. If somebody had said, you can't have any drugs you have to make the movie, we'd have made the movie. Nobody said you can't have any drugs. And we weren't doing anything that interfered with what we thought was our work. So, it was always the work. The work was the most important thing. And the drugs and the alcohol and all those things were secondary to it. And we never, and I always measured it out. If I was getting too drunk, I'd do a little more cocaine, keep the work going. So, anyway, that wasn't it.
So how did it get to the point where you did so much drugs that you ended up not working?
Well, there comes a point where, if you're not the most popular guy in the world and in demand, suddenly people start looking at your behavior and not wanting to work with you. There are certain people that we don't have to name, but there's some very, very big people that it never interfered with their popularity and it never interfered with their careers, and some of our biggest stars. So, and I'm not advising people to use drugs or not to use drugs. Drugs destroyed my life, but I probably would never have found out about it and never gotten straight and never gotten into the trouble that I got into with drugs and alcohol if my career had maintained a level where I was productive.
I get the impression that you've been working really manically since you've been straight.
Mm-hmm. I would have worked manically all my life if I had been allowed to.
I mean, if you got offered enough?
Yeah, I was never offered anything. So at a certain point, my using and my drinking became who's coming out of the dressing room, what, Jekyll or Hyde? Emotional roller coaster is he going to take us on now? So, you know, that's what, unfortunately, drugs and alcohol did for me in my life, and my personal life was a shambles. It never seemed to hurt what went on the screen, but it was the process to getting it on the screen that terrified people.
My guest is Dennis Hopper. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with Dennis Hopper. You grew up on a farm. Were you anxious to get away when you were growing up?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to know where the trains were going. I had a wonderful childhood, though. My mother ran a swimming pool in Dodge City, Kansas, and I lived with my grandparents. My father was at war in the Second World War, and I lived with my grandparents on the small farm, and then my grandfather worked on a larger farm in Garden City, Kansas, and a wheat farm that I would go out and work on during the summer. And I had a wonderful childhood on that level.
Your mother was very religious. She was a fundamentalist?
I don't know where that sort of started. My mother is religious, yeah.
What was your attitude about God?
I mean, when I was younger, she wasn't as religious as she became later in my life. I wasn't raised under any great pressure as her being a fundamentalist when I was a young kid. So that's sort of gotten distorted.
So there wasn't,
religious pressures?
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I could wear lipstick and I could dress as a girl anytime I wanted to. Is that what you mean? Things like that? Yeah, and I was allowed to dance on the table and so on. No, I
took the words out of my mouth.
Thanks, yeah. Wait till I put this lipstick on, will you? No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't have those kind of pressures. I went to Sunday school and things like that, but I didn't have a lot of pressures in those ways. When I first saw my first movies when I was a kid, they really affected me, and I wanted to know how they were made. And I'm not sure that that's uncommon for any kid who first sees his films or first sees television or whatever.
Your first movie role was in Rebel Without a Cause. You were, I think, 18 years old. Did the movie help give you a sense of teenagers being their own culture and their own misunderstood culture? Were you already feeling that way?
When I went on that picture, I saw James Dean for the first time act, and at that point, all I was concerned about was being an actor. I wasn't concerned about, like, you know, whether people were juvenile delinquents or not. I had sort of come out of that, out of San Diego and Tijuana and that kind of area, but I was interested in acting, and I saw James Dean act, and I basically, through Rebel Without a Cause, I was just trying to figure out what he was doing, because I thought I was the best young actor at that time in the world, and I suddenly ran into this guy who was some years older than me, but he was doing work that I was so far over my head, I actually grabbed him on the Chicky Run and threw him into a car and said, "What are you doing? You got to teach me what you're doing."
So what did he teach you?
He wanted to know what my motivation was for wanting to act. Yeah, you know? And he asked me if I'd had a problem with my parents, if I had actually hated my parents. and that that was part of the drive that I had to want to become an actor. And I said that actually I had felt that. And he said, well, that's what he felt also, and that that his mother died when he was very young, and he used to go to her grave and cry on her grave and say, Mother, why have you left me? Why have you left me? And that turned into, I'm going to show you, I'm going to show you, I'm going to be someone. And that was the drive that he had brought into his acting, which I described the same sort of feelings that I was misunderstood by my parents, and that I had that feeling when they came to the theater that I was going to show them. And it was like, you know, I'm going to show you, I'm going to be something, I'm going to be an actor. So these, this drive, this confused kind of drive and wanting to put it into other people's other parts and other things, and these feelings, to use them in some sort of imaginary given circumstance, became the key for acting. But anyway, he said, you must learn how to not worry about the emotions, but you must learn how to do things and not show them. You must learn how to smoke a cigarette and just not act smoking a cigarette. You must learn how to drink a drink, not act drinking the drink. And if somebody knocks on the door, you go and answer the door. Then you see they have a gun in their hand. Then you react to the gun and so on. So basically, it's like don't indicate, but like do something and don't show it. And moment-to-moment reality. Never anticipate what the next moment's going to hold. And so, like, you know, he said, and, you know, you're a very good technical actor, so get rid of all that technique, though. Stop the line readings. Don't worry about how it's going to come out. Just let it come out. Work on a moment-to-moment reality level.
Stop the line readings. What did you stop doing?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I was out of a classical theater background, so, I mean, there were ways of reading lines, you know. I mean, even hello, how are you became a way of reading a line. So there's a lot of ways to say hello, how are you, besides one fixed way that you decide in your room somewhere that that's the way you're going to say hello, how are you.
Was James Dean the first friend that you had who died? I mean, like someone of around your age.
Yeah, I mean, there had been, yeah, I would think, yeah.
Did it scare you a lot to have someone who
was close
to you?
Well, it was more, I mean, more than a friend. I think of him more as a teacher than as a friend. We did two films together, which took about a year of our lives. He only made three movies. We did Rebel Without a Cause and then Giant. And then he died 2 weeks before we finished shooting Giant. So I was like 19, he was 24. It was more, we dealt with acting. We talked about acting. It wasn't like we went out and drank beers together and got high or like race cars or anything. When he died, it just destroyed me. Because I totally had this belief in destiny and how people are destined, you know, to be to fulfill their destiny, you know. And I just couldn't understand why James Dean had died so young. He wanted to direct movies. He had only been in three movies, and it just destroyed my whole concept of destiny, life, and that kind of thing for years. I mean, probably still till this day, it still bothers me. I miss him. I wish I'd have seen his work.
Dennis Hopper recorded in 1990. In a couple of minutes, Roger Corman will tell us about making the biker film that inspired Easy Rider. Here's the ballad of Easy Rider by the Byrds.
The river flows, it flows to the sea. Wherever that river goes, that's where I want to be. Flow, river, flow. Let your waters wash down. Take me from this road to some other town. All he wanted was to be free. That's the way it turned out to be. Flow, let your waters wash down. Take me from this road to some other town. Flow, river, flow, past the shaded tree. Go, river, go, go to the sea. Flow. Flows to the sea, wherever that river goes, that's where I want to be. Flow, river, flow, let your waters wash down, take me from this road to some other town.
On this archive edition, we're featuring interviews about the 1969 hippie biker film Easy Rider, which the Library of Congress just added to the National Film Registry. Before Peter Fonda made Easy Rider, he played the head of a biker gang in the 1966 film Wild Angels. It was directed by Roger Corman, the king of B-movies and exploitation films. Wild Angels helped give Fonda the idea of making Easy Rider. In 1990, Roger Corman told me about the making of Wild Angels.
There was a lot of talk about the Hells Angels at that time, and I remember in, it was either Time or Newsweek magazine, there was an article on them, and at the top of the page was a picture of a Hells Angels funeral. It took place in some woods, and they were carrying the coffin, but the members were riding their bikes. And the visual power of that photograph really impressed me. And I was having lunch with Jim Nicholson and Sam Arkoff, who ran American International, and we were talking about various ideas for a film that we might do together, and it kind of came up between all of us that we all thought the Hells Angels would be a good subject, so we agreed that we would do a film about the Hells Angels. I wanted the Hells Angels not to be the nemesis, the heavies. I wanted them to be the leads in the picture. So I developed with Chuck Griffith my own script, which eventually became The Wild Angels. And for a little while there, I and Chuck were hanging out with the angels, going to their parties and so forth. And the picture became a loose compendium of stories they told us about things that they had done.
So tell me what you were like when you were hanging out at Hell's Angels parties.
I was not quite one of the angels. I made a point of bringing the beer and possibly helping to bring some marijuana and one thing and others. And Chuck and I were reasonably well accepted, but we were never quite with them. I remember at one time I had spent a lot of the evening sitting drinking beer and talking with the old lady that is the girlfriend of the president of the chapter of the Hell's Angels. And Chuck came over to me, and he said, "You're spending too much time talking to that girl. The leader of the angels has been watching you. He doesn't like it in any way whatsoever." And I realized for a little while I had forgotten what kind of party I was at and where I was. So I said goodbye to her and went over and talked to some guys about some bikes.
Now, you cast some actual Hell's Angels as extras in the movie, right?
Yes, we had members of the Venice and San Bernardino chapters of the Hells Angels.
Did they give you any trouble?
No, they didn't really give me trouble. I was very careful as to how I was going to handle them. I thought about it, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to order them around, and that's not my style as a director anyway. On the other hand, I can't appear to be too weak because they'll start to push me around. So I determined that the thing to do was try to be as objective and unemotional as I could, and simply to say, all right, fellas, the bikes start here. You're going to ride up to here. You're going to turn around that corner, and you're going to pull up in front of that bar over there, and you pull out, and you run into the bar. And I would try to say it that way so it was clear what I wanted, but that I wasn't trying to force them to do anything. And I think they understood and appreciated that, and by and large, we got along pretty well.
Did you pay them well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't remember the exact amounts of money, but it was interesting. We worked out the payment. They got a certain amount of money per day for each angel, and then they got a little bit less than their personal fee to bring their bikes. And then they got a little bit less than the bikes for bringing their women. So this was their scale of values.
Didn't the Hells Angels sue you over one movie for using their name and insignia?
Yes. It wasn't so much the name and the insignia, because I'd signed a contract with them. But after the Wild Angels came out and was successful, they sued me for defamation of character. And I remember watching television when the announcer said what announced the lawsuit. And he was evidently reading from a teleprompter or something. And he said they were suing me because I had portrayed them as an outlaw motorcycle gang, when in reality they were a social organization dedicated to the spreading of technical information about motorcycles. And the announcer started laughing in the middle of the television broadcast.
Peter Fonda starred in Wild Angels as like the head of the biker gang. He later starred with Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider. But in Wild Angels, there's something very innocent and vulnerable-looking about him, in spite of the way that he's cast. Did you realize that at the time?
I knew that, and it was a little bit of a problem, because I wanted Peter in the film. He was a good actor, he had the right persona, but he's a very tall, thin person, and he wasn't really as tough or as tough-looking as the Angels. For that reason, I had him wear a couple of layers of clothing throughout the film in order to build up a little bulk. So I was aware of that, but I did what I could.
My guest is Roger Corman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film director and producer Roger Corman. You made the movie The Trip, which was one of the first psychedelic features. Peter Fonda starred in that as someone who makes TV ads and decides to take his first trip. And most of the movie is what the trip is like. Now, the movie opens with a crawl and a voiceover narration, and the crawl says, "The illegal manufacture and distribution of these drugs is dangerous and can have fatal consequences. This picture represents a shocking commentary on a prevalent trend of our time, and one that must be of great concern to all." Is this a sentiment that you believed in, or was this obligatory to the genre, that, you know, to the teen genre? Not that this was a teen movie, but, you know, that you had to have a disclaimer before you actually started the psychedelic trip.
I'd like to disclaim the disclaimer.
Uh-huh.
I had nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Okay.
I shot the film, and American International was a little bit surprised when they saw it. They felt that maybe I'd gone a little bit farther than I might have, and they put that disclaimer on the picture themselves before they released it. I thought it was a bad idea, and I still think it's a bad idea.
Why?
I thought it was corny. The film stood on its own. I didn't think you had to say anything about the film. I think the film just should have played. They played around with the ending. I had set up a very intricate dolly shot ending up with Peter walking out of a house at the beach and looking at the sun as it was coming up. And it was a very difficult shot to get. And they cut that shot up in the final version of the picture and put some sort of a crack across the screen to try to show that his life was partially destroyed as a result of the trip, whereas the theme of the picture was open-ended, that something had happened to him, and I was not saying it was either good or bad. I was just saying here is a new day, something has taken place. The fact that they put that crack in they thought would say that it was bad. The fact of the matter is it just looked kind of dumb, and I don't think the audience understood what it was about in any way.
Now, just as you hung out with the Hells Angels before making Wild Angels, you dropped acid once, I believe, before making The Trip.
Yes.
So how did that pay off in the making of the movie?
I think it was a necessary and a good experience to have made a picture about an LSD trip without having taken one. I think would have been almost disastrous. I would not really have understood what it was I was making the picture about. It did have an unintended effect, however, in that my trip was totally good. I had nothing but good images. And in trying to be fair, I then, in preparing the film, talked to people who had had bad trips and got some information and insight from them and tried to put elements of both good trips and bad trips in the picture because I was trying to be, as it were, impartial. I didn't want to make everything good.
Roger Corman recorded in 1990. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today with Kathy Wolf. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Bob Purdick is our engineer, Dorothy Farabee, our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. But first, are you experienced? Or have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Scream and cry that your little world won't let you go. But who in your measly little world are you trying to prove that you're made out of gold and can't be sold? So, are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Let me prove it to you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall Concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music. Available at record stores nationwide. Little Brown & Company, publisher of Pete Hamill's tribute to All Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Gotham, our book critic Maureen Corrigan talks with Mike Wallace, co-author of A History of New York. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.